Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an Hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and yes, we're getting ready for holidays this week, but we're going to be starting off this week with an aspect of mind power that engages fantasy. Now, all of us love story, right? Well, my guest, Michael B. Cope, he really enjoys stories, and he decided that he was going to enter into the world of imagination and bring out a New Earth mythology. Does it intrigue you? Well, I hope so, because his publication, The Invasion of Heaven, well, there's a lot of characters in here. Michael, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Donna. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you are labeled a Renaissance man. And I just had to chuckle because the picture of you on the back of your book, The Invasion of Heaven, you look like someone that should have been left in the Middle Ages. I really think that's so appropriate because of the story that you have put together. Now, you are an artist in so many ways. You've won awards for poetry. You love music. You've just been involved in so many levels of the arts. Was it something inside of you from the time you were just a little kid that made you want to enter into this world of fantasy, these creatures of personality and life that you have been able to put together in this book, Invasion of Heaven? Did you inherit this pattern, or are you one of these oddballs in the family? Says, where did you come from?
Well, my mom would certainly say so. She often does. In fact, what my mother does is she claims that it all came from her, and I have to agree in a lot of ways. But, you know, I think my interest in fantasy and writing and in the arts actually came from, you know, I think trying to just entertain people. And try to connect with people and try to, you know, pull them out of their day-to-day and suspend their disbelief and entertain. I think that's really the responsibility of every artist in a lot of ways. And in pursuing that, you know, all of these things I've managed to, you know, be a part of and learn from.
Now, you go in also to the realm, the psychic realm. The realm, of course, that's a modern term. Other people would say woo-woo. Other people would say this is reminiscent of the type of stories that would come from the period of the Celts and others. You bring this to life, and at the very first part of your book, we have Northern Idaho. I mean, somebody's going to say, you have got to be kidding. This is where it's going to be taking place? Ah, yes. Northern Idaho.
It starts there. It's a modern mythology, is what I like to call it from time to time. And, you know, it has to do with a psychologist who has a mental break. And while he has this mental break, his wife is leaving him. One of his clients has passed away mysteriously, and he's become a suspect. And he basically goes over the edge. But while he does this, he visits this realm that enables him to kind of make sense of his world and helps him sort the rest of the story out. And it starts in North Idaho. It goes down through, you know, Sandpoint, Idaho, into Coeur d'Alene. Then we find ourselves over in Italy going across the northern part of the boot and back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, what's so interesting is that when he starts going through his experiences, and having been involved in the work of mind for so many years of my life, I can really relate to this because many times there are things that happen that are otherworldly, spooky, I guess you want to say, otherworldly, and it can transform one's life. You can either go into the awareness that this is an open door leading you to something better, or you can become terrified. And I love a sentence in your book. You say, what is made up is real. What is real is made up. You address a perspective of perception. You can ask 20 people to look at a painting and tell you what they see. And it is amazing how 20 people will express 20 different levels of perception. That is a very powerful statement.
You know, most certainly. And, you know, a lot of this, I think, speaks to, you know, how we interpret stories. And I love that you say that how people will interpret a painting. Another reason that I called it a mythology is I became very fascinated with the way when people hear a story, how their behavior patterns will change, whether it's mythical, whether it's some sort of religious story, or it's even a story that, you know, we see on the news. Storytelling changes our perception. And, you know, sometimes the more fantastical, sometimes the more intense behaviors that you'll see. I mean, we can see it even in the world today. Some of the oldest myths are still, you know, affecting us. And it's a fascinating thing for me. So, yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. When we see a piece of art, it will change how we see the world, especially if it's a powerful piece of art and speaks to us on a very human level.
I think that is one of the biggest challenges that someone who works as a therapist or anyone who they're trying to deal with a situation which in one's mind isn't logical at all. There is a story somewhere going on in that person's mind. And they may actually be playing out a role that they have either seen portrayed or they have associated with in some way. There's a trigger. And the statement about reality not being real and what is not real is reality goes along hand in hand in a very nice partnership where the people say, what you imagine and what you put emotion to is what really is going to impact your life, good, bad, or indifferent. It's going to impact your actions. And you bring that out with your character, Marcus. Marcus Reardon.
Oh, dear. Yes, indeed.
Yes. And it's a fascinating thing. And he really is so concerned because in one of his moments, he's out by a lake and he sees something coming up and out of the lake. And I was intrigued with the fact that you chose an eye. I really like that. That was really cool. Why?
Well, you know, the eye itself, you know, there's a lot of baggage that goes along with the eye. You know, we can trace that almost into every mythology known. It's that ability to see, and whether it's the third eye or it's just simply a symbol for us to try to recognize where we are and who we are and some sort of connection. I mean, the greatest connections, of course, that you have with people are when you look them in the eye, and there's so much communication, you know, passed along there. But yes, indeed, you know, one of the things that I started when I first started this story, I thought to myself, how neat would it be to just end the suspense and say that every myth, every story that could be supernatural or no, is true.
Mm-hmm.
From that platform, you can really do a lot. And that's the kind of world there are two psychologists. There's one psychologist named Marcus Reardon, and there's another named Locke Neuwirth. And Locke Neuwirth is the one that has this supernatural experience that changes his life, essentially.
Yes, it does. And you have this very interesting, brilliant character, Basil.
Yes.
And
yes.
I wonder, did you base him on somebody that you actually knew?
Yeah, I think in some ways, sure. I think every one of the characters in there in some way has a little bit of me. In a lot of ways, the story itself is a group of my obsessions. I love music. I love travel. I love international intrigue stories. I love painting, poetry, writing. I even love sword fighting. I'm also a fencer as well. So there's all kinds of little pieces. And I think if Basel is in any way reflected part of me, it's probably that person that I like to actually push paint around on a canvas from time to time. I hesitate to call myself a painter, but I sure love to burn incense, drink scotch, and paint from time to time. Mm-hmm. So there are moments where I'm very much like Basel. But Basel's a very irreverent character, too. He cares very little about any kind of supernatural or spiritual-based existence, because I think his day-to-day life is spiritual because he holds a kind of communion with his muse or his art. But really, you know, that's the way he is. He lives that way. He doesn't really have to seek anything. I think he finds so much contentment just by holding a brush in his hand and, you know, creating, you know, which is probably the closest that we can get to any kind of godlike existence, right? If we're making things.
That's
sort of novel.
Mm-hmm. You've got a couple of statements that I want to share out of the book. The whole world is addicted to being unwell, and there's conversation between Mark Reardon and another person. But there is this statement, to provide for each person the ability to live their lives through compassion, empathy, and kindness, true well-being. The health of the human mind would bring with it a new consciousness. There is a cure to our condition. There is an answer. As more conversation, and then the statement, the truth is always the best answer. And you have scattered throughout this novel, The Invasion of Heaven, little nuggets that if someone is reading, there is this very significant message that is underlying this intriguing story that takes you not just into the world of myth, but it also takes you into the world of today.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Donna, my mother, I dedicated the book to my mother. She spent a very big part of her adult life, and still does deal with this, with depression. And when she was diagnosed with depression when I was probably 12 or 13 years old, it was one of the ways that I handled it was trying to figure out how to entertain her in the afternoons when she's crying and she doesn't understand why. I'd try to bring her stories and things like that to cheer her up. And so I think as I entered into this story, I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if I created a psychologist that was looking for the answer to some of these terrible mental disorders, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be the greatest superhero ever, you know? And so that's where I think a lot of those kinds of ideas come from, are just really, I think, maybe a son's attempt to try to get rid of some of these mental disorders. I'm not a big fan of mental illness. It bothers me a lot, and I guess this is my way of trying to treat it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you also have a comment. A psychologist must confront the particular illness as if it were as intelligent, as knowing, and as conscious as the subject who hosts it. Now, that is an extremely astute statement, because anyone that is dealing with work of mind, other than memorizing textbook stuff, when they really get into it, like Carl Jung did, he's one of
oh my goodness,
who
yeah.
really had the depth yes. of understanding because of what he went through. He walked through
yeah.
a period of his own darkness and came out of it with a wonderful understanding. And his patients, he did have that positioning of attitude. What is the root cause here? What is going on? What is happening? And you bring, again, out these little nuggets of thought that sort of surprise one. But you have these conversations going on between the characters. One of your characters' name is Julia.
Oh, yeah.
And she's quite a gal.
Yeah. Yeah, she's wonderful.
Where did you get her from? Because she's so down-to-earth and practical, it's amazing.
Well, I would love to be able to tell you the way the story ends, but Julia, to me, is sort of the perfect heroine in a lot of ways, and yet she's very, very flawed because she has a past that she doesn't quite yet understand. As the story unfolds, we learn more and more about Julia. And books 2 and 3 really go deeply into Julia's story. She's introduced here in a way that she seems to be very on top of her game. At the end of the book, everything shifts for her. Mm-hmm. And then the second book actually starts for her. But where did I come up with her? I think she's just an amalgam of many of the strongest women that I know. There's little bits and pieces of different women that have affected me through my life. So, her story is definitely one that's going to start to come and bloom further. This first book, of course, is about Locke mostly, but the second book deals very much into Julia's story.
Now, this is a point that my readers would need to know, my listeners would need to know, is that this is going to be a trilogy. So is the beginning of a journey for a person that encompasses a number of very unique individuals and the distortions of thinking on the part of Mark and how he goes through it. So this trilogy obviously is a work in progress here, but I love these little statements about one of the characters, Greenham: I'm not here to hurt you, but to protect you and to teach you. So here he has got this ageless mentor who has had his eye on him for a long time. And Mark, it's really a very good analogy of what we do when we go through life. When life smacks us down, we say, excuse me, I want to put in an order to the customer service department. I didn't ask for this. I don't like this.
Great.
Why are you dumping on me? Can't you pick on the guy down the corner? He doesn't have any problems. Leave me alone. And I don't say that tongue in cheek. I know I've gone through that.
No, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, and so here you go. You go, wait a minute. And so here is this character, the primary character, Mark, and he's going through this, and you could just, in your story, it's like I can see him saying, I don't understand. Why me? Why me? Why me? And, of course, all of this logic follows, which when you're in the why me phase, logic doesn't have anything to do with anything. It's better to have a piece of chocolate cake than logic. It doesn't work. So you have these marvelous, marvelous characters as you go through. And it's a search. It's a seeking. It is all of these mysteries. There is mayhem, there's murder, there's dealing with fear. The very things that people want, even some stuff going bump in the night. I mean, these are things people really like, and you've written it in a modern day environment, and it's cloaking. I mean, who would think Idaho would have anything like this happening? Think of the potato. You don't think of Idaho being much more than the Idaho potato that's in the commercials. Of course, for those of you in Idaho that are listening, know that I love Idaho. I think it's one of the most gorgeous places on this planet. But seriously, most people haven't been to Idaho. So what's Idaho? A potato. But the thing is here, you have taken and created this wonderful journey that when people are reading it, and they're going through the book, they're going through, oh, what's next? And you don't want to put it down because you're afraid you're going to miss something. And you go in, you touch on, because you are a poet, you bring something out, about the muse. And then we'll go back to the power of story, and you subtly weave this in. And it's a good halfway through the story, and how a good story can change the game, feed them what they need to get them to change. We become what we manifest. The stories we envision become us. This is the real gift. The real gift And that's going full circle to what you were talking about before we went on the air. You were saying I'd ask you if you were ready for the holiday, and you said, oh, yeah, I'm going to go down and visit family, and we're going to be sharing stories. And I thought, that is so cool. That's what makes communication so wonderfully engrossing, are the stories we share. Not statistics and metric measurements. Stories. Stories of experience. Stories from the heart. I mean, it's just, it's a fabulous thing. And again, you weave this in throughout the book, Invasion of Heaven. And I like this, you have to learn how to forget what you think art is. Stop trying to control it, and for your own sake, let it give to you. That's what any teacher of art is. Now, when you were writing this story, did you find that it had its own grouping of muses that kept you company?
Oh, most certainly. Yeah. It's strange when ideas come and you start to flow. You know, any writer or artist will tell you that. And, you know, you just kind of get into a zone and you have a communicator, have a conversation with, you know, some people will say, you know, your keyboard. But there's something else in the room sometimes. Absolutely. You know, there's something really wonderful happening and up in the air and around you. Certainly. Certainly.
Now, one of your characters has a conversation discussing omniscience, and I thought...
Omniscience, yes, omniscience, certainly,
yeah.
Sure.
And this is something that when people hear the word, they go, that's interesting, and they have a particular perception. Now, I said omniscience, you said omniscience, and there's a difference, isn't it? But yet, word has... two words in it, omni and science.
Absolutely.
So it's
absolutely.
It's a fascinating play with a word.
Well, I love words, I love etymology of words for sure, and it's neat when you come across a word that, you know, omniscience and, you know, the story, omniscience is someone who knows everything, right? You know, so like you have an omniscient narrator. And then, you know, omniscience, of course, is, you know, that it's mainly in religion. It's the capacity to know everything there is to know. But I love the word science in there. You know, it's knowing. It's not believing. It's not, you know, having faith in something. It's knowing. There's a difference. There is something scientific about it. It can be proven in three or four different ways, you know. And is omniscience possible? Well, not really, at least for us. I don't think we could handle it. In a lot of ways, I think omniscience, true omniscience, or at least a brilliant, frightening power of omniscience is delivered through the paintings of Basil Fenn. I think his artwork is something that, you know, obviously causes damage to those who see it. It's an incredibly powerful piece of art. And again, that's another commentary that goes throughout the book, is what does it mean to be an artist and not be able to share with an audience, especially when your work has an omniscient, the ability to really share what it's like to be alive, that most of us probably couldn't handle.
You have immortals in this story.
I do.
And these are characters that really nobody even pays attention to, because they are just what they are, and they go on and on and on like the Energizer Bunny. But with Marcus, they, you know, I have often thought, boy, that would be boring, just to be an immortal, to be in the same chassis and to go for maybe thousands of years doing all kinds of things, seeing all kinds of stuff. But you make it intriguing because of the immortal that you have in this book, and how this immortal plays a very, very special role. And I loved your sentence, newly discovered immortals happen every now and again. And I go, oh, my goodness, here we go. We've got another one. And you talk about intention. And all of this is part of the mythology, this I'll use the modern mythology that you've created with the invasion of heaven. And you bring out all kinds of different points of information that the immortals share. When you started this book, The Invasion of Heaven, did you feel it was going to end up being a trilogy? And I want to ask you a question. In doing the book, in having book number one, when did you know to divide it into book two and book three?
The first part of the question, if I knew it was going to be a trilogy, I really did. There's so much more to the story that comes up, obviously, in books two and three. And I knew that I couldn't fit it. As this being, you know, my first published novel, I was a little afraid to publish a 2,000-page work. You know, I didn't know how well that would go along. When I arrived at the end of The Invasion of Heaven, I knew exactly where I wanted it to end, and I knew the two twists that I wanted to put on the end of the story to keep everyone intrigued and myself intrigued, certainly. So it was really easy for me to know when to stop. The other thing that I knew, too, is that I read a lot of book series, and there are some so amazing authors out there, so just writers that just make me shudder when I think of them. But one thing that I really wanted to do that I guess just to kind of suit my own artistic approach was I didn't want the three books to have the same kinds of structures. I don't want to write three books that have the same voice. I want each book to kind of be able to stand on its own in a way and experiment with different, different points or essentially just different structures. So, for example, this first book is a present tense omniscient narrator, and then the other half of the book is inside of a journal. So it's first person past tense, and it's an interesting way to kind of structure the novel. The second book, which I'm about halfway through, about waist deep in. Is structured after one of my favorite movies, just the structure itself. I'm sure you've seen The Godfather 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So basically this next book is structured sort of like, what's happening in present tense. And then we get to go back all the way back to 1387 and learn why these characters behave the way they behaved in the first book. And then we get to follow them in present tense as well. So it's kind of a flash back and forth in this next book.
Well,
and the third one, I'm not sure what the structure is going to be, actually.
It'll breathe its own life into being.
I hope so.
Yes. One of the things that I will share with those of you who are listening to the show today, this is a fascinating read in that it will take you through journeys of thought that, along with your imagination, will create worlds of images that you would not have necessarily decided you wanted to conjure with these associated characters. It's absolutely fascinating. And I would say if you want to get the first one, because he's got two more that are coming out, that's a trilogy. This is part one of the New Earth mythology, The Invasion of Heaven. Michael B. Kep is my guest. And it is Be Like Boy Kep, and you can go to his website, Michael Be Like Boy Kep, and his last name is spelled KOEP.com, and you can find out more about someone who not only is talented artistically, but his love of words and his vivid Renaissance thinking has enabled him to combine multiple worlds into a story that fits the modern environment. Michael, thank you so much for being my guest today. This has been a lot of fun.
Donna, it was a real thrill to be here. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's my delight. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. When we come back, we've got fun things to share. So don't go away. More good things to come.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. I wanted to share a story with you today about the Benghazi heist of the century. Yeah, well, it's some information that Brian Houghton, who is a wonderful researcher, came up with, and it's all about ancient treasures. So I'm going to be chatting with you about that. I want to give you a heads up on who's coming up. Tomorrow we're going to be playing music. Amy Hindman is my guest, and her music is titled In My Waking Dream. And so we will be sharing a lot of that with you. Amy is just a delightful musician, and her lyrics are very, very powerful. And then we're going to be talking with Michael Eastwood. We're going to be traveling to England. We're going to be talking about crystal cards and his wonderful book that goes along with crystal cards called The Unfolding of Our Light. And Michael is renowned for his knowledge about crystals and the value they have and their meaning, and these crystal cards are just gorgeous. Also, we're going to be live on Thanksgiving. Yes, I'm going to be doing a broadcast, and it will be same time, same place. And I want you to know it's going to be an open mic hour. So if you're busy fixing the bird or whatever it is that you've got going on and you want to chat, that's going to be a great thing to do. For Nobody's Eyes, Nick Redfern is going to be my guest, and we're going to be talking with him on Friday, and it's sort of about conspiracy theories, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Nick has been on my show more than one time. He is also a researcher, a person that just checks out so many different things, and it's so much fun always to have him on the air. By the way, if you want to give me a call me at 888-627-6008. Yes, if you're a first-time listener, know that I am delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. And my goodness, I'll tell you, it's just amazing how fast the days are going. I mean, the holidays are here. Gee whiz, I feel like I just took care of things, cleaning everything up from last year. How does it go by so fast? Well, I think it happens because we just get so busy. We've got so much going on. And before you know it, there it is, ho, 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 and jingle, jingle, Happy New Year. Well, I wanted to share some wonderful thoughts that were sent my way regarding how to remember those in the military. And if you're interested in sending members of the military a care package, if you will, these are some suggestions that were passed along to me, and I thought that they really, really were good ones. If you belong to a church or community organizations, many times people, all you need to do is say, how about if we do such and such for those in the military, for the families in the military, or the gals and guys overseas? Well, people come up with such wonderful, innovative ideas. And there's a lady by the name of Brittany Catton. She works with the Armed Services YMCA. In fact, they have a website, theasymca.org. ASYMCA.org. And there's, you can go there and you can offer to do something. Or there is anysoldier.com, anysoldier.com. And Deanna Cole is a participant and works with militaryfamily.com, militaryfamily.com. She said it's like Match.com for care packages. Troops sign themselves up and specify their needs, and you just determine the soldier you would like to help and just send what you want. Now, these are the tips that they have for shipping and mailing. The U.S. Postal Service has priority mail, flat rate boxes, and OperationWeAreHere.com is a resource for military supporters, and when you use an APO, FPO address, you'll get a discount on the postage. So I wanted to share that with you because things like this can mean so much for those that are away from home. We've got a caller on the line. I want to welcome the caller to the show, first name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Hey, Donna, it's Pat in Connecticut. How are you?
Hi, Pat. Boy, I bet you things are getting festive in Connecticut.
A little bit, yeah.
Now, Pat, let me see what I've got for you. First thing that I am looking at is you are going to find yourself feeling like you're between a rock and a hard spot with a financial issue, but actually it's going to resolve itself. I don't see it staying around very long. And that's because I am aware that instead of getting panicky, you're just sort of going to sit quietly and say, all right, how can this be managed? And what's going to evolve because of you're not getting panicky? You're going to find that you're going to mention something to a few people that you know and ask for suggestions, and you're going to find that someone will have such a good suggestion, it fits perfectly with what needs to be taken care of, and the pressure is off. You're really making some changes in your thinking and your perception of what's going on in your life. And you're leveraging it now. Instead of looking at something oppressing you, you're going to say, how can I make it turn into something that's going to work for me instead of against me? And I think you are expanding your social circle, too, which is excellent. I think this is very, very important for you because isolationism does not serve you well at all. Not at all. And you have been becoming more aware of this. And so consequently, because of these little subtle shifts that you are making, you are going to go into the year 2014 with a sense of, I really can make the changes that I want. And I'm seeing someone handing you some money. It's not a huge amount of money, but I'm seeing you saying, I'm very grateful for this. This is wonderful. This is unexpected. And I think it's going to be an opportunity for you to generate an income for yourself that you would have thought was possible. But it definitely is. Very, very much so. And I think you're going to get some other ideas that are going to generate some income for you. And they're just, it's like little tiny baby steps that you're making forward into your life. You're just moving right along. And I like this. I think that this is very good. You do need to consider using a sinus rinse. It could just be simple saline, just salt water, lightly put together. And that's going to keep this irritation in the sinuses at bay. And I don't know why, but it seems like extreme cold really affects your sinuses, and they can become very irritated. So if you have something like a very light saline solution that soothes the sinus membranes, and I think you'll be able to feel a lot better during the colder temps that are coming in so quickly. What question do you have for me today?
Oh, wow, Donna. Thank you for all of that. And, you know, what you're saying is very, very hopeful, and I'm working towards all that, but I don't see it, so I'm glad you do. And I'm struggling so hard with depression. I've gotten myself off all meds, and I've been determined to stay off of them because I think they've damaged me. And I'm at a point, the past week or so, I've been wondering, do I need to consider going on them? I really would like to know that I'm going to make it through this and be able to heal my brain.
Well, I think that you can make it through it, but the challenge is there when you have been involved in taking meds. If you go, let's say, cold turkey, it's quite a trauma to the system. And what I'd encourage you to do is to find someone, and I would talk to a pharmacist. I'd find someone that has a knowledge of chemistry, because the brain needs particular components, and those components chemically, if they have become, the cellular structure has become dependent on certain things, you need to talk to someone that's knowledgeable about chemistry. And I think a good pharmacist that you could spend some time with could assist you and might make some recommendations. And I think that you might be able to diminish a level of what you have been taking and perhaps eliminating one.
I'm sorry.
You need to talk to someone that has the chemistry.
I'm off all meds.
All right, but you still need to understand chemistry. Now, you may not be able to understand it, but you have to talk to someone that does. Because when I know of a woman who tried, I'll give you this. This is a simple example. I know of a woman who wanted to trim down. So she decided she was going to eliminate all carbs, all sugar, and I forget what else it was that she was going to do. Well, she didn't realize that the brain uses glucose. It's going to create sugar, or try to create sugar. The body will try to create sugar to feed the brain, because that's one of the primary substances that the brain will need. That's why people that are diabetic, they've been told for I don't know how long, have a piece of sugar, have something there, have a carb. So she went cold turkey, and she just found her body went into a shock level, and she learned the hard way. She almost went into a low blood sugar coma. She learned the hard way that she has to allow her body to adjust. She has to let her body tell her what works. Now, for her, sugar is not necessarily a bad thing. She's not eating buckets of it. But she has to remember she has to have some kind of a carb. If she tried to do away with the carbs, and this is her physiology, and that's what I'm trying to convey to you. You have your own unique physiology. You are going to need to play the part of a detective. That you want to be away from the meds is fine, but if you have a chemical imbalance in the system, let's say you were lacking serotonin, or you were lacking some other component that your body needs, and our bodies change as we get older. So if you're lacking that component, there may be another way of introducing that component in. Will your body adapt to that? Will your body utilize this alternative component? And those are the questions that need to be asked. This is something that I think when it comes to medicine, we really have not evolved yet to understand the nature of a person's chemistry. And I think you can go and have some blood tests and have that analyzed. But understand, medicine can have its purpose. Everything has come from what we've observed in the plant kingdom, in the animal kingdom. We have extracted from that. But your herbs are a medicine of its own kind. It all has to do with your chemistry and how your body is going to utilize it. So the fact that you're off of meds, that's wonderful, but you are dealing with something that is going to require observation in the sense of your being a participant in the observation and keeping a diary. And I would strongly encourage you to talk to a pharmacist who is going to understand what your concerns are and what you're going through. Sometimes, especially when winter hits, you have sad. I mean, up here in the Pacific Northwest, where I live, there's a lot of people that are plagued with it because we have so much gray. It just has a tremendous effect on the chemistry. So these are things, dear. Be an explorer. Ask questions. And if there is a need for you, for balance, to take a medication to help you get back into balance, know that if you have a good doctor and you have a good pharmacist, they'll make you aware of alternatives. Some of them perhaps may come in what's considered a natural form, but don't ever think that herbs are not as potent and can cause just as many problems as what we define as modern pharmaceuticals. All of it has to be respected.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're welcome, dear. You take care and you have a wonderful day, and don't be afraid to talk to people about this. Don't be afraid.
I will. Thank you so much.
You're
welcome,
honey.
Thank you. God bless you, Donna. Happy Thanksgiving.
Wonderful, wonderful holiday to you as well, my dear. This is Donna Sebo. When we come back, well, I've got a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and something more to share with you. Don't go away.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. I wanted to share with you some information that Brian Houghton had put out. He has this wonderful publication called Ancient Treasures. And I was just so intrigued with this batch of information regarding the treasure of Benghazi. Do you remember when that was in the news? Well, it came out in 2011. There was a huge civil war. And they call it, they question it, could this have been the heist of the century? There was a major robbery from a bank in the city of Benghazi. And it was an archaeological heist. Yes, well, history has been replete with that. Egypt was relieved of millions of pieces of archaeological treasure through the centuries and sold. There were a lot of people. That was the one way that they made money. So the grave robbers were very well acquainted with what went on and would take advantage of robbing the dead as much as possible. Now, the treasure of Benghazi that was stolen was, it consisted of coins, jewelry, statuettes that originally came from the site of Cyrene in northeast Libya. Now, there have been a lot of questions regarding this theft, and in May 2011, the report should have been made. That's when this heist occurred. However, nobody said a word until October of 2011. Now, when you have something that big, you'd expect it to be on the front page of every publication in the area. However, looting was so widespread in Libya in 2011 that archaeologists were not telling the public the truth. They were saying, oh, everything was safe. However, the word was coming out through the underground of communication that the museums were being looted big time and ancient sites were being destroyed. Now, they wanted to blame it on NATO. However, they found out that that wasn't the case at all. NATO didn't have anything to do to. In fact, the people that were in charge of the bombings that were done via NATO avoided bombing archaeological sites. In fact, they were given a no-strike list of cultural heritage institutions in Libya. So there's a lot of questions here that go on, and the history of the Middle East is just amazing, and they're discovering more and more about it. Cyrene was an area that in the 300s was conquered by Alexander the Great, and after Alexander died, then it came under the control of a Greek general, Ptolemy the First, and it became a Roman province eventually. And in 365, there was a huge earthquake that hit. And when it hit, then by golly, it started to deteriorate. Now, what happened then is really interesting because the area started changing. The weather changed. Water access changed. It just was a whole shift done by nature, as well as some nomadic tribes that decided to take over the area. Natural disasters? Yes. Warfare? Absolutely. They are finding still parts of Cyrene, and it has been designated a World Heritage Site by the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization that we know more recognizably as UNESCO. This was done in 1982, and they had all kinds of artifacts that were found, but they don't know exactly when the Benghazi treasure was evacuated. They do know that the treasure is a collection of various things that were discovered by an Italian archaeologist. Actually, there was more than one archaeologist, and they just were amazed at what they were able to find. So here are all these treasures. The British come in, mid-19th century, they find a whole bunch of stuff. However, they really didn't know what they had until the early 20th century. Why? Because the Archaeological Institute of America excavated at Cyrene in 1910 to 1911 under the direction of a man called Richard Norton. And something very dramatic happened at that time. A man by the name of Herbert Fletcher de Coo was shot and killed by Arabs. The government said all excavations have to stop. Now, the Italians were excavating up until 1942, and they just found all kinds of things. Gold, silver, bronze, glass, bone, ivory. There is a disc called Thasos Disc. It's a 14th century inscribed clay disc, which he discovered in 1908 at the Minoan palace site of Thasos, 2nd millennium BC on Crete. But there's all kinds of questions. You know, there's all kinds of things that come up. But and, you know, it ended up in someone's collection, and they think, they don't know for sure, because the information wasn't put out, that there were between 7,700 and as many as 10,000 objects. And this is what they do know. There were 364 gold coins, 2,433 silver coins, and 4,484 bronze coins of Greek, Roman, Byzantine, and early Islamic origin. 306 pieces of ancient jewelry, necklaces, bracelets, anklets, rings, gold earrings, armbands, precious stones, and 43 other very ancient items, including a gold foil plaque that showed a battle scene, all kinds of figures of bronze, glass, ivory, and terracotta, scarabs, limestone head, all of this was in that. Now, in 1942, well, story goes on, but I'm out of time. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You're the captain of your soul. Life is so interesting. Aren't you glad you're a part of it? If not, you should be, because the adventures of life, well, they're ongoing. Again, remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Write your own script. Enjoy your day or evening wherever you are on this wonderful planet. Talk to you manana. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.